2237.
Good morning and welcome to Shattering This. I am Yada. Each weekday morning here on GCN, we strive to expose the deadly and destructive myths which are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission here is to help you understand what is happening behind the headlines, even trying to predict on occasion how these events will shape our world over the next 20 years. During our first hour this morning, however, we're going to engage God on His terms. We invert the program on Friday to accommodate the schedule of IQ Al-Rasuli, who lives in Europe. IQ will be joining us again so that we can continue to diagnose many of the issues associated with the Quran, and the more that we can demonstrate that Islam is hopelessly errant and irreconcilable with either rational thought or with civil liberties, then the more comfortable I think people will be in trying to rid the world of this horrid disease. And as we continue in our discussion of Yahweh's Torah, we are now to the point that we're beginning to consider the seventh day so that we understand why God created the universe with this very unique pattern of 6 + 1 = 7. If you would like at any time during the next 3 hours to join us to participate in this discussion, you're invited to do so. Our number is 1-877-300-7645. Well, one of the things that we learn very quickly on is that creation and the story of creation is actually very effectively understood when we appreciate the formula of 6 + 1 = 7. And that is why God's creative aspect, the work that He did to bring the universe and life together, played out over the course of 6 days. And that on the seventh day He rested, because that is the way that human history will also play out. We will toil for 6,000 years once exposed to the world outside of the Garden of Great Joy, the Garden of Eden. And then on the seventh day, we will return to the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden and live 1,000 years with God walking with us on this planet and with the entire earth returned to the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden. This period of time begins with this statement. Thus the heavens and the earth were determined complete, and all of the divisions of spiritual beings were complete. So everything that God designed, He had completed during the six-day period. Now, for those who may be new to the program and saying, well, that's, you know, really silly. The universe is somewhere between 14 and 15 billion years old. It wasn't created in 6 days. And for those who have listened, you know the answer, that time is not relative or is relative to all individuals, and it slows at a place of great energy or great velocity. We can measure the rate that time flowed at the point of creation so that a witness to or the architect of creation, we know exactly how fast or slow their clock would have been relative to time on this planet right now through the cosmic background radiation. And so through that process, we are fully capable of analyzing God's clock. And He tells the story of creation from the place of creation. And when we measure the stretching of time through the cosmic radiation background that we have that screams to us throughout the universe, we find that we divide that stretching of time, which is 10 to the 12th power, by the 14 to 15 billion years the universe is old, that we end up with exactly 6 days. So His testimony is precisely accurate. Now, the whole purpose of creation is reflected in its formula. Yahweh introduced Himself as the lone architect, the singular builder, the lone mover on this first day because God is one. He created Adam in his image with an anosmia, with the ability to think, to reason, to discriminate between that which is good and that which isn't on the sixth day. He didn't create Adam out of nothing. Adam was made of the same kinds of elements that all other animals were comprised. And he gave to Adam some very unique gifts that we considered yesterday. Well, not all unique. We have a soul, as do all animals. We are given life, as are all animals. We are given existence, as are all animals. We are not given a spirit, however. But we can use the unique thing that God gave us, which is our nesama, our conscience, to reason our way to acquire a spirit. The better choice, of course, is Yahweh's spirit, but there are two types of spirits available for us to choose. One would be the spirit of those malach, the messengers who rebelled and have fallen, and the spirit that will not only make us eternal, but enable us to get to live in God's company, would be the spirit associated with our spiritual mother, the set apart spirit, the Ruach Kodesh. And we can use our ability to observe with our soul, our surroundings, even the Torah, and especially the Torah, and our ability to think so that we can make a reasoned choice because we were given the gift of free will and acquire eternity in this manner, and also develop a relationship directly with God. So God, who is one, created man on the sixth day. And he did this because alone, God lived a life that was void of loving relationships. Without loving relationships, without the existence of a free will environment, then God was not in a position where he could grow. Eternity would get to the point where it was quite mundane. And so like parents coming together, you know, men and women coming together, husband and wife, mother and father, when you raise children, your life is enriched by the very experiences that you have with them. The more that you give to your children, the more you get in return. Very much like God in his covenant family. And so he conceived and created a universe capable of supporting a being that could choose of its own volition to fill the void in God's life. Now, the matrix was specifically staged to bring this being and God together by adding 6 to 1 and thus achieving from God's formula perfection, which is man with God. This realization suggests that Yahweh is as much a plot smith as he is a mathematician. Every element of revelation, redemption, and relationship relate to aspects of this perfect pattern of 6 plus 1. No matter the question, if the answer is important, it is 7. One of the most misunderstood aspects of the passage that I just read to you is this word called Saba. In Saba was read as that not only were the heavens, the spiritual realm, and the earth, the material realm, were determined complete, so were all of the divisions of spiritual beings, Saba. Saba is understood as host of heavenly messengers, envoys, all arranged in a command and control structure. And so you'd look at hosts and you'd say, because 85% of the time the Shabbat appears in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, it is translated, and I'm not even sure it's a translation, but it certainly is translated and represented as host 85% of the time in most Bible translations. But if you look up the word's meaning, it's in lexicons, the kind of thing that you will find is war, army, battle. And they comprise the majority of the renderings. Now, I don't think one person in a million knows why host was selected or what this choice of word implies, because it's used a lot. God says that he is Yahweh of hosts, Yahweh of Shabbat. So why would he choose such a word? Well, the word is defined, as I shared with you just a moment ago, by scholars to mean a military congregation or large fighting unit, a division of an army. Now, if we were to extrapolate superficially based upon this rather human line of thought, it would imply that Yahweh has competitors and that he either requires defending or covets conquest. After all, conquest, defense, and control are the sole purposes for militaries. But since the notion of multiple rival gods is a complete conflict with Yahweh's proven testimony and with reason, and since by definition a creator with sufficient energy to produce our universe isn't short on power, there must be another reason for God selecting what by all means is a fairly militaristic term. That is to say that there isn't a battle being waged. I think there is one being waged, but it's not being waged such that God needs an army. It is a spiritual battle for every soul. We will delve further into this over the programs over the next few months, particularly as we move into our presentation of specifically what transpired in Eden, where Eden was, why it was conceived, what it means to us, what we can learn from it, and how we are going back to those conditions. And also, we will spend a number of programs strictly on the concept of Nesama so that we understand what a conscience is and understand why there is a battle in political correctness, in our media, in our classrooms, and in our political arenas to render our Nesama moot. The whole concept of political correctness is that we should not be judgmental. The Nesama is our means to exercise good judgment. Now, I share this with you now because there is some merit to the fighting aspects of Shabbat, at least when we see it through a lens that is focused on the forces that we are battling and that are trying to get us either to acquiesce to love or that want us to surrender and therefore submission. So scripture, when seen as a fabric, suggests that Yahweh's malach, which comprise his Shabbat, are spiritual messengers. They're spiritual envoys. And when we return to Shattering Myths in a moment, we will consider their nature and how they differ from us. I'm your host, Yetta. If you wish to engage in this discussion, 877-300-7645. This topic that we're on now is one that I probably get more questions on than any other. It is not particularly easy to understand, but it is absolutely worth the effort. I'm also going to remind you that I never claim to be perfect, never claim to have the corner on truth. I'm constantly learning, and I share what I've learned, and when I've made a mistake, I'm the first to say, well, I'm glad I learned that I had erred there and try to correct the record. So what I'm going to share with you on Malach is what I've learned over the past 10 years. It does not mean that everything that I say is precisely accurate, but it is certainly as accurate as I'm capable of presenting this concept. The term Malach means messenger in Hebrew. It speaks of an envoy. The messenger, however, is not a messenger in the free will sense. The messenger cannot create or present his or her own message. The messenger presents the message of the one who sent him. It is very much like what Yeshayahu, the prophet Isaiah, although he was not a malach, what he did relative to Yah's testimony. Yah said, I want you to write this down. God speaks in first person through most of the prophets. And he's just saying, write it down. Well, the Malach carry out God's orders. They do not have free will. That doesn't mean that they can't choose to rebel. It's just that when you do not have free will, you have an immediate consequence of actions which lie outside of that opportunity that you have been given. In the case of someone, for example, in the U.S. military, if you are a U.S. Marine and you are given an order by a lieutenant and you are a sergeant, and it is to do something that you don't think is in your best interest, and you say, nope, I do not want to do that, I'm not going to do that, unless that order just happened to be grotesquely immoral, you're in real trouble. You're either going to lose rank, you're going to lose money, or you're going to lose your freedom because you're going to be incarcerated. That's the issue in a military environment. Yes, you can rebel, but that's not a choice that you have been given. You do not have free will to do as you please because you are in a command and control regimen. The same thing is true with the Malach. It was possible for a Malach Hasatan, Halel bin Shakar is his name, it was possible for him to rebel. But since he did not have the authority to rebel, he was not conceived with free will. With rebellion, he suffered an immediate consequence, as did all of the Malach who followed him. Now, when you understand command and control versus free will, man was created with free will. We can do as we please. Many of our choices are counterproductive. You know, we've created religions which are all rotten to the core. Here's the President of the United States talking about the sacred day of Easter, and every aspect of Easter is Babylonian and pagan. I mean, you can't be very smart, or you can't care very much about God's nature if you celebrate Easter. I mean, Easter, the Babylonian rite had a bunny that laid eggs. Bunnies don't lay eggs. But that's the Easter bunny and the whole myth of the eggs. The eggs were in bright colors to represent spring. The eggs and the bunny were both fertility concepts, metaphors and symbols of fertility. The colored eggs were designed to show the birth of spring, because it's always done on the Sunday closest to the vernal equinox, just like the Christian version is. It was even named after Ishtar, which is one of the names given to Astarte, who claimed to be the queen of heaven and the mother of God, because the sun impregnated Mother Earth on the vernal equinox so that 9 months later, on the winter solstice, today's Christmas, the son of the sun might be born. Hot cross buns, the crosses, all part of it. The counterfeit bun, which is leavened with yeast, all part of the corruption. Every aspect of this day is purely pagan, including a God who dies and is resurrected. And yet here even the President of the United States talks about celebrating it, talks about it being sacred. Just one example of the fact that we have free will. He did so, and he still lives. We have free will. Malach do not. Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yetta. We're considering one of the more interesting aspects of creation, because God has just told us that he had completed everything that he strove to accomplish, and that among them was the Shabbat. And the Shabbat is one of the more interesting aspects of the universe as it exists now. The Shabbat, or Malach, it's the Hebrew word. In Greek, Malach was translated Agelos, Agelos is the Greek word for messenger, and because Christians, unfortunately, have so much influence over the perceptions of God, Agelos was transliterated into angel. And in the process, of course, all of the meaning and understanding that Malach would have provided was lost. The Malach are simply messengers. They're spiritual messengers, which means they are comprised of light, their energy, which means they are immortal. So there's lots you can learn just from the way they're presented. If you are spiritual, if you're a spiritual being, even God cannot kill you. There's many things God cannot do. And one of them is he cannot extinguish a spirit. That is why Sheol was conceived, and it is described as a black hole. It's a place where time is infinite, but all other dimensions are contracted to nothingness. There's no fire. There's no torture. It's just a internal, eternal prison for wayward Malach and for human souls that are born unto them that do their bidding. And so Malach as a spiritual being is eternal. They have that over us also. When we come to, and we spent a lot of time doing this in these past few months, you come to understand the relationship between energy and matter. You come to understand and appreciate the fact that the Malach are vastly more powerful than we are. Because when, although energy and matter are the same thing, the same stuff, substance, they are not equivalent. That's what E equals MC squared means. That matter must be multiplied by this, by the speed of light times the speed of light to be equivalent to, equal to, energy. And so the Malach as energy are vastly more powerful than we are. And they are eternal. And we only become eternal when we embrace the terms and conditions of Yahweh's covenant and we attend his invitation of Pesach, Matzah, and Makotim. Now, that does not mean, though, that the Malach are greater than we are in every conceivable way. They are not, because they do not have free will. That's why God's presentation, initial presentation of them as Shabbat, as spiritual envoys in a command and control regimen, was so important. And he chose a term that we would be able to relate to. Everyone knows. Back in the time of Imperial Rome, if you chose or you were inducted into the Roman legions, for the next 20 years of your life, you had no free will. Your immediate officer and the officer above him could tell you where to go, who to fight, provide you what you were going to eat, told you where you're going to sleep. They had total and absolute control over you. If you chose to reject any one of their orders or instructions, you'd be hunted down and killed. And that was the case with virtually every military around the world. So by using Saba, God clearly told us what the limitations are of the Malach. Now, these Malach are messengers, they're envoys, they're implements, they're tools. These implements have no capacity to be creative. They have no capacity to love. They don't hate because they cannot love. They cannot conceive because they are not creative. Now, understanding this also gives us a much better understanding of the kind of corruptions, for example, the President of the United States was promoting relative to Easter. You see, because the Malach represent, there's good Malach and now rebellious Malach, what we call the rebellious Malach demons, and for want of a better word, let's use that term, that the rebellious Malach, because they are Malach, because they were conceived without free will, are incapable of creativity. Creativity requires free will, as does love, as does hate, almost any form of emotion. That being the case, when Hasatan and his minions choose to mislead humankind, so that rather than choosing to engage in a relationship with their Heavenly Father through the covenant, that they're beguiled into worshiping Satan as if he were God. And the God presented in almost all religion is modeled far more off after Satan than anything else, because just look at what they're called. Almost every religion refers to their God as Lord. Lord is the very title that Yahweh ascribed to Hasatan, because unlike God, lords want to be worshipped. They want to control. They want to own. They want people to bow down to them, the antithesis of what God wants. And so when you recognize that, one of the first things that that helps you understand is that all religions, therefore, and God is opposed to religion, all religions will be counterfeits. They will be corruptions. They won't be inventive. And when you look at that, the only way to have a popular religion and to be, have it be inventive is to have it be conceived by an individual as opposed to one of these fallen spirits. It's conceived by a fallen spirit, as is Christianity. Paul said he was demon-possessed. As is Islam, Muhammad acknowledged being demon-possessed. Then what it's going to be is a counterfeit. It's going to take elements of truth that Yahweh has conceived and revealed, and it's going to twist them and counterfeit them, corrupt them, so that it leads people in the wrong direction. And therefore, what you will see in religion that is leading people to Satan as opposed to God are strokes of truth, just blurred, corrupted, counterfeited, twisted. The kinds of things that a being without free will, without creativity, can do. And what you find is that it's vastly more beguiling. When I tell people that Paul admitted in his second letter to Corinthians that he was possessed by one of these fallen Moloch, just read it, that's exactly what he says. He says, the thorn in my side is actually a goad. It's a scorpion stinger. And the goad was something that was used to control animals. So the goad in his side, the thorn in his side, was a messenger from Satan, one of these fallen Moloch. And when I tell people he admitted to being demon-possessed and that his letters actually create a construct that has the people who believe him are worshiping Satan as opposed to developing a relationship with God, they're flabbergasted and they can't comprehend it, because there's this misimpression, this errant connotation that if someone is worshiping Satan, it must be purely occult. They must have a devil symbol there. They must have, you know, an inverted pentagram there. They must be calling on Satan's name. Well, most people don't even know Satan's name. It's Halal ben Shakar. Satan simply means adversary. Does Satan want to be known as the adversary? No. Does Satan want to be worshipped as an opponent? No. How does he want to be worshipped? How does he want to be known? How does he want to be perceived with humankind, as God? And so the moment you recognize that's the case, what you would expect is, for example, in the religion of Islam, Allah is modeled directly off after Satan. Every aspect of Allah's character is satanic. And yet in the Quran, the author of the Quran, which is really Satan, the one that inspired it, is against Satan. And if you're just superficial in your thinking, you say, well, how can Allah be Satan if the Quran is opposed to Satan? Because the last thing that Hasatan, the adversary, wants is to be known as the adversary. He's opposed to the whole concept of the adversary. He wants people to bow down to him, to worship him as God. And then everything begins to make sense for you. It was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life was when Yahweh encouraged me, this is before I really knew him, and it's typical of God, you know, Moshe didn't know Yahweh when God appeared to him and said, you know, I want you to do a mission with me, was to have that mission be exposing and condemning Islam. Because by doing it, I came to know everything that God was not. I really came to understand the antithesis of God. By studying Islam, you understand the motivations and the character and the ploys of Hasatan. And then you can see them in other religions. I began to see them in Christianity. My eyes were opened. And then the comparison to that, the alternative to that, which was Yahweh's Torah teaching, is so much more liberating, so much more enlightening, so much more attractive than is the religious alternatives. So it is, there is advantages to understanding the spiritual environment that exists around us. That first of all, man does not have a spirit, and that there are two types of spirits. Yahusha was talking about this as well when he was speaking to the religious and political establishment in Jerusalem. And what he said was that the religious types, the religious clerics, and those who were politically empowered were born of serpents. Serpent is the metaphor for Satan. You know, Satan slithered into the garden as a serpent, as a snake. And so God is opposed to these things, but he wants us still to understand that we can be born from below, born of serpents, and become a spiritual being, and therefore at the end of our mortal existence, we'll be incarcerated with them, or we can be born from above in the spirit of enlightenment, the spirit of truth, and the spirit that is set apart from Yahweh. So with these malach, they are simply messengers. The more interesting adaptation of malach is malacha, which is used throughout Yah's testimony. The malacha speaks of the work done by Yahweh's heavenly messenger. It's feminine and speaks therefore directly to the set apart spirit. And we learned that malach, they're not compensated, so it's inappropriate to consider them employees. They aren't equals, so they're not partners. They're implements. They're tools. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. We're speaking about a fairly complex thing, but I think the more we talk about it, the more we at least scratch our noodle and say, let's try to understand this, the better we understand the universe we're in, God's nature, what he is offering us. The thing that we know about malach is they cannot procreate. Yosha told us this, that they do not marry. Malach do not procreate. We will become a lot like the positive side of malach in eternity. There is no bodily resurrection. That would be going backwards as opposed to forward. We become energy-based creatures in eternity. And so we then, as an energy-based entity, will not be procreating. So as a result, they are not family. They don't even resonate with the concept of family. And I think it would be fair to just to consider them their tools engaged in the work of God. Now, if I'm right, and Yah's Torah, prophets, and Psalms seems to support this conclusion, as does Yahusha's testimony, the malach who comprise the Shabbah, the host, which are better known as the angels because of the Greek word, they're greater than we mortals are in that they're eternal in time and to some extent have a greater capacity to travel within the dimensions of time. They are also comprised of substantially more energy than we, making them more effective implements. As a result, these spiritual beings are considerably more knowledgeable and powerful than we are as humans. But without the capacity to choose freely, they would be incapable of love and severely diminished in creativity, causality, or conceiving anything, because these things are dependent upon the execution of free will. Now, please consider this example. Short of breaking, which would be a singular act of rebellion, a shovel has no option but to dig when and where the user dictates. That does not mean that the shovel isn't valued or useful, only that it has no free will. and thus no ability to create or to dig on its own. The heavenly host are messengers. Even the fallen Moloch, or demons, are like this in a way. Therefore, while mortal, comparatively powerless, and trapped in time, stuck in the ordinary flow in time, and as physical beings, which are flawed, we are vastly superior to this heavenly host, the Shabbah, when it comes to the things which are born of choice. We have creativity, causality, communication, compassion. These, not surprisingly, are hallmarks of God, which is why he said that we were created in his image. There are insights related to these conclusions that we should probably cover as well. The first deals with eternity. Immortal, the spiritual messengers or envoys, whom we call angels, cannot be killed, even by God. That is why Yahweh created the abyss as a prison for Hillel ben Shakar, better known as Satan. Satan simply is a transliteration of the Hebrew word, the adversary, ha-satan. And for the divisions of Moloch who rebelled against him, that's what these black hole prisons will be. The abyss is a place of perpetual separation. But the other rebellious Moloch and all human souls who associate with these demons and serve with them will be eternally incarcerated. Their emotional agony will be the result of enduring eternal yet conscience, cognizant separation. They will know that there was a far better option, but that their choice to rebel was counterproductive, and they will have to live with that for eternity. Now, this cause and effect is described eloquently in Matanyah, Yah's gift, Matthew 23, a passage that we will dissect in future reviews of God's creation. And there in this Matanyah, which means Yahweh gives, or Yahweh's gift, 23, we discover that religious, political, judicial, academic, and media leaders and their associates who promote damning deceptions, thereby leading people from life to desolation, away from God, that they're going to join the demonic or fallen messengers in the abyss because they will be considered to be in league with them. Souls reborn in Yahweh's spirit will likewise become immortal, but we will spend our eternity with our Heavenly Father. Therefore, if eternally estranged from HaSatan and his ploys. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. We'll be back after the news and commercial break.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you...